I'm Laura Bush. I'm chairing this section, which is session 261, Crisis of Faith, Experiences Among Faithful Mormon Intellectuals. And have you all got your phones off by now? Just check one more time. All right? So let me explain who Matt Connolly is and then his respondent, John DeLynn. Matt is an internet marketing professional at orangesoda.com and the founder of a new company yet unnamed that sells niche media products. He received a bachelor's degree in history from Brigham Young University and a master's degree in religious studies from Harvard University. Matt likes to read, write, build organizations, watch sports, play sports. You saw the Jazz up there. Listen to music, experience the great outdoors, and spend time with family and friends. And I just met Matt, so I'm excited to get to know a little bit more about him. John DeLynn, I know a little bit more because John has been on the Sunstone board and had served several months as Sunstone's executive director. He's the founder of several LDS-oriented internet sites, including the very popular Mormon Stories and Mormon Matters podcasts and blogs, along with a new online forum, MormonsForMarriage.com. He has a bachelor's degree in political science from BYU and a master's in instructional technology from Utah State University. He currently works for the Massachusetts Institute of Technology as director of the Open Course Ware Consortium, and he lives in Logan, Utah with his wife, Margie, and their four children. Take it away, Matt.
Despair, depression, gloom. It was a dark, cold night in 2002. I sat limply at my bedroom desk, my head hanging down. What if there really is no God, I said to myself. What if there is no afterlife? What if death really is the end? Darkness engulfed me as I pondered the cold, hard implications of these possibilities. Could it be that my entire theological paradigm was wrong? Was it possible that the cosmology I had embraced as a Mormon Christian was not, in fact, a reality? I had believed these things my entire life, the last decade even more so. Of course, I had doubted before, but never on this level. On the contrary, I had been a stalwart in the cause, a loyal advocate, eager to take up the apologist's cause. My belief had been so fervent, my religious excitement so great, that I had voluntarily lived in Brazil for 2 years as a missionary. There I had preached my faith with passion, urgency, and above all, a heartfelt conviction. To think that my efforts and belief might have been misguided struck me with intense pain, a pain greater than I had ever before felt. I had never before lost a loved one, but I had observed the bereaved. I had marveled at the depth of their mourning, a pain I was never able to fully understand. But now I understood. That dark night I mourned. I mourned what I thought was the death of my faith. That was me 6 years ago. And for the next 5 years or so, I went through a very difficult phase where I seriously questioned my belief in God, my belief in Mormon theology, and my commitment to the church. It was by far one of the most difficult experiences I've ever been through, stretching my spiritual, intellectual, and emotional resources to the limit. I'll call that experience a crisis of faith. In fact, I can't think of a better word to describe it than crisis. To question your entire worldview, your entire view of the universe, all of your values, the very foundation of your life, if that's not a crisis, then I do not know what is. This challenging experience, this crisis of faith, is what gave birth to the study that I would like to summarize for you today. This presentation is based on research I conducted as a graduate student at the Harvard Divinity School in spring of 2007, so just last spring. The bulk of the research is based on a series of private, one-on-one, oral interviews I conducted with six highly educated Mormons, all of whom described themselves as fully active in the Mormon Church, but who had at least once in their lifetimes undergone a serious crisis of faith experience. I chose this particular group for a reason. I wanted to learn for myself how it was that intelligent members of the church dealt with some of the same concerns that troubled me. More importantly, I wanted to know how these people were able to deal with their doubts and still remain deeply committed to the Mormon Church. I love the church with all my heart, and I wanted desperately to see if these people could provide me with guidance on how I could remain a deeply committed Mormon and still maintain my intellectual integrity. As it turns out, my decision to learn from these wise people turned out to be one of the best decisions I ever made. As an aside, this research that I'm drawing from will be published in an upcoming issue of Sunstone, probably this fall. So if you want more in-depth information, you'll have that soon. So what I'd like to do now is just take a moment to look at a brief profile of each participant. What I'd like to do is really paint a picture of these people so that you can realize that these are people just like me and you. These are people with families, with children, people with who have possessed a very strong commitment to the church, and who yet underwent these extremely difficult experiences. Let's go ahead and take a look at each one of those. We'll start with Mark, Mark Peterson. These are all fictional names, of course, to preserve anonymity. Mark's from a western U.S. state. He's Asian American, Mormon, baptized at age 8, highly active in the church, between 52 and 56 years old. Mark has a doctorate degree, and his profession is as an educator. Let's meet Sasha. Sasha Johnson. Sasha is also from a western U.S. state, Caucasian, Mormon, baptized at age 8, high level of activity in the church. She's a young girl, 25 to 30. At the time of the interview, she was a master's candidate. Michael. Michael was born in a northeastern Utah state, Caucasian, Mormon, baptized at age 8, high level of church activity, 80 to 87 years old, the most mature of all of my interviewees, a doctorate, he had a PhD, and worked during his career as a scientist. Let's meet John. John Allen. John is also from a western U.S. state, baptized at age 8, Caucasian, high level of church activity. John is a younger gentleman, 28 to 32, doctoral candidate. Tom Smith, also from a western U.S. state. I think we may be seeing a pattern here. Baptized at age 8. Church activity level is very high. Age range 58 to 66. He's a doctorate level education. Working as a consultant. And finally, let's meet Helen. Helen Green, also from a western U.S. state, Mormon, baptized at age 8, Caucasian, high level of church activity, doctorate degree, and is currently a professor. So, okay, let's go ahead and start. Before I jump into the interviews, what I want to point out is that every crisis of faith experience is unique. I'm going to draw some conclusions from this research that point to some common themes that we see among this group, but I wish to emphasize that every individual's experience is different, and it's impossible to really categorize a crisis of faith experience into neat little categories. Having said that, let's ask the question, what is a crisis of faith? I think for all of us it may mean different things, but what did the participants say about this? How did they define it? For Mark, Sasha, Tom, and Michael, each of them said that a crisis of faith experience is one where one who previously held a strong commitment to the Mormon Church begins to seriously question that commitment and considers abandoning it altogether. And by the way, that happens to be my own definition as well. The lone member of the interview group that defined a crisis of faith differently was Helen. And Helen said that a crisis of faith experience is not necessarily an event, so to speak, historically locatable in time, but is an ongoing phenomenon experienced continually by all people who have faith in the supernatural. So, let's go into the next major question as I ask these people about their crisis of faith. I particularly wanted to know, what is it that caused this experience? In other words, can you look back at your life and pinpoint an event or events that perhaps precipitated or caused this crisis of faith experience? Okay, so let's look first at Sasha. Sasha described her crisis of faith experience as having its roots in her first visit to a Mormon temple. She had recently been called to serve a full-time mission. As part of her preparations for missionary service, she went through a temple for the very first time. She said she was disturbed at first by what she saw there. She found the temple clothing strange, and she was shocked by the ritualistic nature of the temple ceremony. She said she did not recognize it as, quote-unquote, her church. She said that during her first visit to the temple, she could not feel the Spirit of God. After that experience, she entered a period of despondency, where she began to question her commitment to the church. If the temple ceremony was not inspired, she reasoned, then everything else about the church was probably wrong, and she wondered if she could remain a part of it. Her doubts were serious enough that she thought about not following through on her commitment to serve a full-time mission, for which her departure date was just 2 months away. John's crisis began as an undergraduate student when he decided to take several courses in religion from a non-Mormon university. John said, "I knew I would be studying material that might contradict my Mormon understanding, so to better prepare myself, I decided to take off the band-aid by exposing myself to the controversial and perhaps unflattering side of Mormonism." John did this by reading Fawn Brody's controversial biography of Joseph Smith, and by reading a couple of books on historical critical methodology, one about Moses and one about the historical Jesus. Now, after reading Fawn Brody's biography of Joseph Smith and those two books, John said this, "I felt lonely in the church because I didn't think that many other members knew about or understood this material." And that's definitely something that I think that I could empathize with as well on a personal level. Okay, so here are some other reasons that people gave about specific doubts that seemed to cause their own crisis of faith experience. And I just do this in the interest of time, just to summarize. Other things that we heard, or that I heard, learning about lesser known elements of church history, such as polygamy, concerns about specific elements of Mormon theology or doctrine, including the existence of God, Mormon cosmology, and the status of women and homosexuals in the church. Reading books written by non-Mormon biblical scholars that interpret the Bible much differently than commonly accepted Mormon interpretations. One person I interviewed was candid enough to state that he felt that his crisis of faith may have been caused by living at least one area of his life contrary to the principles of the gospel. And then, of course, there were the obligatory concerns about Mormon culture. Okay, so this is really what I want to focus on, is how did these individuals choose to resolve their crisis of faith? Obviously these were things that were heartfelt, deeply felt, things that bothered them intensely. Many of them described that they had a difficult time sometimes getting out of bed each day. They felt that their crisis of faith experience reached that level of intensity. So what I found most interesting was how did they get from point A to B? We know from looking at their profiles that all of them are currently highly active in the church. So how did they get from this point of being down in the depths of despair and of doubt in the throes of these crises of faith experiences, and then end up on the side where they are now, which is the status of being deeply committed to the church? So that's what I want to focus on here. There's six, as I went through the interviews, data, and I don't want to be too scientific about this because this is personal experience, but I had to look at it somewhat from a scientific view or my professor would have flunked me. So there were six themes that I observed as I kind of waded my way through these different interviews. One I'll call aha moments. Another one is new assumptions, relationships, spiritual witnesses, choices to commit, and personal reflections. All six of these things were themes that I noticed in terms of, and that played an important role in these people resolving their crisis of faith experiences. So let's talk about each one for just a minute. Let's talk first about aha moments. Okay, so I'm defining an aha moment as a moment of inspiration where the doubter realizes that there may be a way to resolve the internal dissonance. I'd like to read just an example of that for you. Michael, who, as you recall, was the older gentleman who was a scientist by profession, he one day during the throes of his crisis experience, was reading the Bible, in particular the book of John, chapter 8, verse 32, where he read this verse, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And as John started to think about that, as Michael started to think about that, he told me that he came to the realization that, and for the very first time in his life, that he realized that God would never ask him to believe anything that was not true. And for him, that was a liberating moment. It was a time where he was able to step back and say, you know what? Even though I've got all these concerns, these doubts, these fears, God's just not going to ask me to believe anything that was not true. And he said that for him, that really kind of changed the trajectory of his experience. Let's talk next about new assumptions. One thing that was very clear is that as the people worked through these, the participants worked through this crisis of faith experience, they had to reinterpret their faith on many levels. And you know, I'll call these new assumptions. They had to change the assumptions that they made about church doctrine, for instance, church theology, church culture, so on and so forth. So we'll say that a new assumption is replacing old assumptions with new ones. And this turned out to be a key in resolving the dissonance for all participants. The new assumptions led to radically reinterpreting long-held views. As you can imagine, that was a very difficult thing for some of these people. And as they were very candid in the interview, some expressed that these are things that they're still working through and that they feel that, you know, they probably will be reinterpreting their faith until the day they die. Let's look at one of the new an example of these new assumptions. This one comes from Helen, who said, "I had to discard the either-or approach to religion. Either everything about the church is true, or it's all false." And I'm sure that most of us have probably encountered this in our lifetime as members of the church, or perhaps even as observers of the church, for those of us who are not members of the church. It really is something I think seems to be deeply embedded, at least in the way that Mormonism in our generation is interpreted, where, you know, either everything's true or everything's false. And, you know, as you can imagine, and as many of you have probably experienced, this often leads to many difficult intellectual and spiritual conundrums. And so so I found it interesting that every single participant had, to some degree, been forced, really, to adopt some of these new assumptions. It was really one of the only ways they told me that they could resolve the dissonance that they felt. A third major element is relationships. And specifically, speaking with mature mentors who could truly empathize and help them work through their concerns. This ended up being a critical element and something that I personally have experienced as well on a very deep level, which is that it's very difficult when a person is in a crisis experience to get out of that without some guidance from people who have been there before. You know, so this is where wise, mature, intelligent members of the church really become extremely valuable in terms of their roles as helpers and as mentors to these people who are going through these difficult experiences. I think that sometimes, especially for younger people, and I'll include myself in that category, I think that it's easy to miss things, to miss connections that you could make that would ultimately benefit you and help you, and help you see that there is, in fact, a way that you can maintain your intellectual integrity and still be a deeply committed member of the church. You know, let's look at an example of relationships, of the role that relationships played in the life of John. John said that the Mormon intellectual community, an undergraduate advisor of his, and a wise Mormon scholar were critical to helping him fight through his challenges. He talked to me about nights where he would go and sit with his undergraduate advisor, ask him difficult questions about religion. He did the same with this wise Mormon scholar that befriended him, and he shared a lot of his concerns with him. And as he did so, he found that he was having a difficult time connecting some of the dots, and that these people were able and willing to help him do so. And he credits that as being an enormous influence in terms of his being able to overcome the internal dissonance that he felt during that time of his life. Let's talk next about spiritual witnesses. Every single participant in this study mentioned that at some point during their crisis of faith experience, they underwent what some of them called a spiritual transformation, where they had some sort of spiritual experience that helped confirm to them that That there was a way to resolve it, to resolve the dissonance. That there was a way for them to come out of this okay. I'd like to show just one example of that. This is from Tom, and Tom was a very interesting person to interview. Of all the people I interviewed, he was probably the most candid and honest in his answers. And he's the one that told me that during a certain portion of his life, when this crisis of faith happened, he attributed that to his not living his life the way that he should. And Tom said that for him, he just had two or three different spiritual experiences where it just really struck him on a very deep level that he had to be true to his inner voice, that he had to be willing to follow his conscience. Okay. One thing that I should mention is that for each of these themes that I'm working through right now, when you get a chance to read the paper, if you do, I'm just showing one example. There are probably five or six examples for every one of these, and so I apologize for the short, abbreviated nature, but due to time constraints, that's what we've got to do. So, okay, let's move next to choices to commit, and I found this very interesting, especially for me as someone who tends to analyze things probably way too intellectually, way too much with my head sometimes more than my heart. Four out of the six people that I interviewed said that, you know what, at the end of the day, you've got to make a practical decision to commit to a Mormon lifestyle or to some other lifestyle. And this is something that I heard over and over again. This element of practicality. And, it's the way that I was analyzing my own crisis of faith experience at the time, I wasn't even considering what was practical. I was considering only what felt right. What I felt would be the best thing for me to do, how I can maintain my intellectual integrity. That was my preeminent concern. But these people talked a lot about the practical elements of committing to a Mormon lifestyle. Let me just show you something I found very interesting from Sasha. She said, "We can't just focus on what feels right all the time. Otherwise, we might be embracing a new worldview every other week, and that's just not practical." Sasha's great. As I said, she's a younger girl, a good friend of mine, and she also happens to be someone who very, very much wears her heart on her sleeve. She's a very emotional person, and is the type of person who I think, if she had not made this decision to practically commit, she would be changing her worldview every week. And so I found it particularly wise, courageous, even bold of her to make this statement. Okay, so personal reflection. So this is kind of the last phase that I saw people work through as they were reflecting back, I guess, on their crisis of faith experience. And the common element that I saw among all of them in terms of this was that all participants consider their crisis of faith experience to have been good for them. They all deeply expressed deep appreciation for the fact that they had gone through such an incredibly grueling experience. Every single one of them, without fail, or without exception, I should say, said that they were a stronger person because of their crisis of faith experience, that they felt closer to God because of their crisis of faith experience, that they were better people as a result of this. And this is my favorite quote from John. "I've had many crisis of faith experiences, and I hope to have many more." And when I first interviewed John, he was one of the very first people that I interviewed. And I think I was probably a little bit too uptight about the process. I was kind of wanting to guide the interview maybe a little bit too much, and kind of hoping for certain answers from him, and because I had to have him fit my little paradigm. And so when John said this, it kind of really threw me back on my seat. And, he kind of laughed when he said it, but he was dead serious. And the more that I've thought about it and reflected upon this for the last year or so, the more I've found this to be incredibly insightful. The fact that these difficult experiences that stretch us and force us to really question our commitments, question the major assumptions that we hold about life, about our religion, ultimately, those those stretching moments, that pressure that is put upon us, makes us stronger people if we respond to the pressure in a positive way. And again, all of these people I interviewed, I think, are examples of individuals who courageously embraced this challenge and who I think did respond to a lot of these challenges responsibly. So what I'll say is this. At the time of the interviews, each participant had resolved their crisis of faith in such a way that they are deeply committed to the Mormon Church, are fully active members of their local congregations, have faith in God, and love and appreciate the Mormon community. All four of those points are things that each one of them expressed to me. And so I took a lot of courage out of that myself. And again, was impressed with the courage that they showed in the way that they tackled this difficult experience. So, what about me? You know, how did this study affect me as an individual, as a Mormon, as someone who loves the church, as someone who was going through a very difficult crisis of faith experience myself? One of the most important lessons that I learned, is that doubters don't usually doubt because they dislike the church, but because they love the church intensely. And this is something that that I really feel strongly about, because I think sometimes in Mormon culture there is often a tendency to quickly want to brand somebody who's doubting as an apostate or a dissident or something like that. What that does, I think, is it has the effect of casting that person as an outsider or as someone who doesn't have a strong allegiance to the church or as someone who doesn't have a strong love for the church. But I think, these participants in these interviews are a perfect example of this, is it's exactly the opposite. People that go through these experiences love the church so much. And if they didn't love the church, then the intensity of their crisis of faith experience would be nowhere near as serious as it is. And so that, I think, is an important thing to take away from this. I know I personally took a lot away from that. Second, I wish to emphasize this because I feel like it was a critical part of the study, a key discovery. And maybe it was not such a novel discovery. Maybe it's intuitive to everyone else. But really, spiritual mentors are critical to helping people overcome a crisis of faith. And I see this as a major problem in the Mormon church and within Mormon culture. I've seen way too many people, friends of mine, even family members of mine, struggle through a crisis of faith experience without having a good, solid, mature spiritual mentor to help them through an experience of that type. And in my opinion, it seems, you know, I don't have any numbers to back this up, but just based on my own experience, the majority of people who fall into that camp, who don't have those relationships, tend to leave the church. They tend to decide that, hey, you know, this isn't for me. You know, the only way I'm going to resolve this dissonance is if I just shut this off and just walk away from this. And it always ends up being an extremely painful experience for them to kind of extricate themselves out of Mormon culture, out of the Mormon worldview. And friends that I have that have done this, even years ago, are still tortured by it, frankly. And so, in my opinion, there's a lot that can be done within the church in this regard. You know, and a lot of people will say, maybe the best answer is to have the person talk to their bishop or stake president if they're going through an experience like this. Based on what I've seen, that can produce a mixed result, depending on the type of bishop or stake president that the person shares their concerns with. You know, I've seen some state presidents just dismiss crisis of faith experiences as, they just need to say their prayers more. They just need to have more faith. You know, but most of us know that it's not that simple. There's so much more to it than that. And I think that, you know, it's tough for our state presidents and bishops. You know, these are people who, some of whom don't necessarily see the world from an analytical viewpoint. They don't necessarily ask a lot of these same questions. And so I think an individual in that role, who's put in that role and forced to deal with a crisis of faith experience like this, is sometimes ill-equipped. And ultimately, that ends up hurting the person who's struggling with the crisis of faith experience. So my solution, and I talk more about this in the paper that will be published soon, is for bishops and stake presidents to identify key members within their local congregations that are familiar and conversant with this type of experience and who have come through it successfully, and then to pair that person with this doubter in an informal way. I think if it was done as a formal calling, it would ruin everything. But to have it be an informal relationship where they can go out to get something to eat once in a while and work through some of these things. So I just, again, want to emphasize how important I think that is. Probably many of you in this room are capable of filling that role. I know that John Kessler, who's a good friend of mine, has filled that role for me, and I very much appreciate that. John is an outstanding individual. So let's talk about one other thing. Another thing that I thought about is really important is that I think in a crisis of faith experience, we're kind of overcome by negativity, by doubting. And so as a result, we kind of tend to focus on all the things that are wrong with the church rather than the many things that are right with the church. And in my opinion, that kind of thinking ultimately ends up being fairly self-destructive. I know that for myself, when I'm able to look at the church through a positive lens, through a grateful lens, through a charitable lens, I'm much, much more likely to give it the benefit of the doubt. It changes my heart when I look at the church in that way. And why shouldn't I look at the church in that way? There have been so many positive things that have come into my life as a result of my membership with the church. I mean, I could go on and on about all of the wonderful blessings that I have received as a direct result of my membership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And why in the world would I ever want to dismiss those to focus on the few things that maybe are bothersome or that I perceive to be flaws? I think that at the end of the day, the reason a crisis of faith experience is so incredibly difficult is because of the internal dissonance that it creates within an individual. When your entire worldview is turned on its head, it really throws your life into crisis mode. I remember that for myself. There were just so many days where I wondered where I would be in 10 years. Am I still going to be a committed member of this church in 10 years? How about 20 years? How about 30 years? Those are tough questions to ask. I was someone who was raised in a very, very devout Orthodox Mormon family. I love my family so much, and my parents were excellent examples of people who believed and lived Mormon values. And for me to suddenly question all of that and to go through this experience is by far the most difficult experience that I've ever been through. And I've been very grateful for the opportunity to work through these concerns with a lot of people, spiritual mentors, friends, and this study in particular has given me a very special opportunity to understand these experiences better and to know that I'm not alone, that there are other people out there who have had very difficult experiences, who are doubting. Maybe someone who's sitting next to you in church is right in the middle of one of these crisis of faith experiences. Maybe one of you in this audience is right in the middle of an experience like this. And I don't want to be too preachy, but I just want to offer hope that there is a way out of these things, that there is a way to cross the threshold, so to speak, to go from being to go from being down in the dumps, so to speak, and very, very concerned about your faith and where your future in the faith is headed, to being a very highly committed member of the church. Most of these people that I interviewed held very responsible callings in the church. And I don't mean to suggest by stating this that if somebody decides that the church isn't for them, despite their best efforts, that somehow that person is less responsible, because that's not true. I think that people need to follow the path ultimately that they feel is best after doing their darndest to work through this experience. But I do believe that there is a way out. There have been plenty of people throughout the history of the church that have crossed this difficult divide. A finality of a crisis of faith experience, because I know that's probably what a lot of you are thinking, does a crisis of faith experience ever really end? Well, my opinion of that is that is that it can end. I think there's, you know, and maybe this is me thinking too categorically, but I think there are levels of crisis of faith experiences. Some are so intense that you're thinking about leaving the church the next day, you know, whereas some, like Helen described, she lives with it every day as a person of faith who believes in the supernatural. You know, and we never necessarily get away from that. It's something that we experience continually. But I believe that it is possible to escape that level of crisis of faith experience where you're reconsidering your commitment to the church every day. That's really not a fun way to live. And these people are excellent examples of individuals who have been able to overcome that in positive ways. Thank you.
Well, I'm asked for your forgiveness ahead of time because this is a topic very near and dear to my heart. A few of you may know a little bit about that, but it was in, I don't know, 2000, 2001 that I started going through my crisis of faith. And It was a very traumatic experience, and it was something that I never envisioned. And it's something that rocked me to the very core. And I was fortunate enough to be able to work through that a bit. And when I left Microsoft and came to Utah, I decided to just put together a little podcast where I would try and explore some of the issues that I had struggled with the idea of maybe helping some people go through the journey in a way that was a little less destructive for them. I did about 150 hours of interviews or of discussions put my name and my email out there just to get a sense for who might be listening or who might be paying attention, just to see if anybody cared or if anybody resonated with what I was trying to do. As I'm looking down into my email box right now, I think I've received about 5,000 emails in the past 4 years from various people in various different types of conversations. I received an email once. I was just going through and pulling up some of the ones that were most prevalent to me. I had a man write me, and he said, "For now, I will tell you that I am an active but disillusioned somewhat with the church. I used to be a hobby apologist, but could no longer defend what became undefendable. I'm currently serving as the bishop of the blank ward, and am 4 years and 9 months into that call. I was about 2.5 years ago when I concluded, much to my dismay, that the things were really not what I had always believed. I had a strong and abiding testimony of. It has been very difficult to come to that point while serving as a bishop. But still I maintain my faith in God and Christ and much of what I have come to love from the LDS Church." I had another man write me talking about, you know, he'd been 33 years in the church, lived in Utah County, had been very devoted to the church. Then as he started through his crisis of faith, he said, and then something happened just recently. The state president called me to the state high council. I was in a really bad situation now if I was to refuse. I would be admitting to those close to me, especially my wife, that I wasn't really over these new feelings and that can of worms would be reopened, and I really couldn't afford to put my family through that again. So reluctantly, I accepted the call. Now I have entered a very dark place. I've traveled around. I've had a job where I've been able to travel around the country. I've been able to sit in a pizza parlor and hear a young lady talk to me about her crisis of faith and her preparations for temple work and the shock between what she anticipated in the temple and what the temple experience actually was, and how excited she was to go and how heartbroken she left. I've counseled with grandchildren of general authorities who have struggled with things that they weren't able to talk to their parents or grandparents about. at various level of degrees. Even last night from a very dear friend. It was like 5 in the morning and I woke up and I got in my email box an email from a very dear friend that said, "I think I'm not going to be Mormon anymore. I feel like it has wreaked psychological havoc in me." And I remember a movie that I saw a year or two ago, Superman. And there was this point in the movie where Superman is trying to solve all these problems, and he flies up into space and he looks down upon the earth and he sees all the lights and all the people, and he sees all the havoc and the pain of the earth. And I think it's kind of comparing him a little bit to the Savior, what the Savior and God might feel when he sees so much pain on the earth. And it's, as I've been able to get through these thousands of emails, a small sense of how much pain there is in the church right now, along with all the joy that's in the church. It's just so humbling to me. It's so overwhelming. Spouses that can't talk to their spouse. Children that can't talk to their parents. People who can't talk to their bishop. They can't talk to their neighbors. They feel completely isolated and alone, and it's quite a desperate situation. Matt, I want to thank you for taking the time to try and explore this and understand it deeper. Matt's been working on this, so I didn't get to actually see much of the presentation before he offered it, so a lot of these thoughts are just sort of extemporaneous. But I just want to maybe convey with you just a few thoughts that I have. Matt, the point that you made that that these people are not people who don't take the church seriously, but instead it's people who take the church very seriously, is probably one of the most important things I heard you say. It's so insulting to tell somebody that just pray and read your scriptures, because these people overwhelmingly are the people who spent the most time on their knees and their most time with the scriptures. It's so insulting to insinuate that their falling away from the church has to do with some type of iniquity or sin, because these people, by and large, are the most loyal and committed people to the church prior to their disillusionment. In fact, the only reason that they were driven to question is because they cared so much, not because they cared so little. And so, to insinuate that they're somehow lesser or less inadequate, I've had people write me and tell me that they're so in love with the law of tithing that while they can't feel comfortable paying tithing to the church, they can't let tithing go. And so they've found other places to give their tithing. That's the rule in my experience, not the exception. These are often the people who care the most and are the most committed. And I've been able to interact with enough of these people to understand that there are a few things that are really helpful. And there are things that are not helpful. When I think about a dear cousin of mine, he and his wife got married and didn't really take the church seriously at first for many years. And then they had a child, and the wife decided that the church was very important to her. And the husband felt somewhat gypped and disillusioned, because all the fun and the excitement that they were having was now being taken away as the attention turned to the new child. And so instead of sort of being able to move together, what they ended up doing is something called collusion, where she would assert how important the church was. He would then assert how the church wasn't what it claimed to be, which would drive her to be more interested in the scriptures and more interested in prayer, which would drive him to dig more and more into anti-Mormon literature, which would drive her to become even more committed and devoted and to attend Education Week at BYU as if it were a sacrament, which in turn turned him to become one of the most, a very angry, bitter person. And this obviously has ripped their marriage through its very core. And I love these people, and they're very good people, and they're very kind people, and very loving people. But that's a tragic thing that people have to go through, and it's happening all over. As I reflect upon my own crisis of faith, one of the most powerful things that my wife did, when I turned to her on that day and said, "I don't think the church is what it claims to be. I think that we may need to leave it." She cried, and I watched the tears fall, but then she looked at me and she said, "But I trust you. And I know that you'll do what's right." And that was one of the most powerful things that she could have done, because she totally handed it over to me. And when I had to look forward and say, "All right, we've got children, we've got a whole network and a family in the church, are we just going to throw it away?" giving me that choice and that freedom and that trust made all the difference for me. And so that's something that was really helpful and can be really helpful. But most of the time, these people need a few small things. They need to know that they're not alone. You wouldn't believe how many people aren't able to talk to even their spouse about these issues. In fact, I run this little private bulletin board, and I once had two spouses simultaneously come to me and say they wanted to be on the board, but they didn't want to be on the board if their spouse was going to be on the board because they weren't able to share with their spouse the things that they were able to share with this online community. And it turned out that both felt the same way, but they weren't able to actually talk to each other about that problem. And that's not the first time that that's happened. So if people can just know that they're not alone, it turns out that there are thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of people out there that are struggling. That's step one. And I think that's sometimes the most important barrier for people to get over. The second, people need a community of support. They need a bunch of people who can say, I've been there, I understand, I love you, there's nothing wrong with you, I feel those things too. But a community that's willing to encourage in a positive way, because there are bad communities that can discourage people and breed cynicism. And those communities aren't helpful. People need role models. And if any of you are able to attend the Why We Stay presentation today, those are some brilliant examples of people who know everything, who know more than any of us, who have been through more than any of us, but have chosen to find ways to maintain their membership or their belief or their affiliation or whatever they've been able to maintain. So there are role models out there, but people don't know about them. So it's our job to help promote those role models. People need encouragement. Because it's easy to start out saying, okay, I'm going to try again, but it's so easy to fall back down into that discouragement. And then finally, they need family and friends that can support them along the way and not tear it down. There's a lot that I could say about this. But I guess I'll just read you one last email. I received an email from a man named James in Florida. And he wrote me and he said, last night I had my interview with my state president for a temple recommend so that I may be sealed for eternity to my wife and three of my five children. For 33 years I never thought that I could do this interview, let alone answer the questions as needed. With your help I did both. And I don't think that staying in the church is always the answer for everybody. I think that there are exceptions and there are probably instances where leaving is the right answer. I really do believe that. But it's not about church membership. If there's one thing I know is that these people who do leave the church, they go and try and find other churches, and they might become Unitarian or Episcopalian, or they may become atheist, or they become seekers again, and that's not a bad thing. But the truth is, what you think you're going to find isn't always there. And someone once told me about a presentation Elder Holland gave, where he admonished the youth of the ward he was serving in. He said, you're not smart enough to leave this church. You're not smart enough to make it on your own without the church. And at first I was like, oh, what a horrible thing to say. But there's wisdom and experience and truth in what he was trying to say. And it's not about church membership. It's about the fact that life is messy. Life is complicated. Life is complex. And life can be a jungle, it can be ferocious. And we need friends, and we need community, and we need a set of morality, and we need a set of rules, and sometimes we need some authority to talk us in to helping us follow the better angels of our nature. And I don't take what Elder Holland said literally, but I've seen enough people who have struggled as they've tried to find their own way to know that sometimes we'll struggle together a lot more successfully than we will trying to struggle alone in isolation. And so it's not about church membership so much as it's finding wholeness and finding peace. And that's the biggest aspiration I have. But the saddest thing about this email that this man James wrote me is that he's complimenting me, and I'm thinking there are so many better people who could be saviors on Mount Zion in a broad, non-literal sense for these people who are struggling. And so I would just ask those of you who know these issues better than me and who have worked through these things so much better than I to try and step up and lend a hand and reach out because there's just so much need and my inbox is full. So, thank you.
We're really short on time, but we do have about 2 minutes, so maybe a couple of questions or comments.
So, I really thank you both for the spirit and the intensity and beauty of what you said. And there's not enough time to respond to everything. I think it appears to me that you're talking mostly about the sort of dissonance between a person and the church that's primarily based on beliefs and intellectual problems and not on like abuse situations and the sorts of situations that people feel alienated in those situations would be really different sets of lessons you would learn or something like that and it's really biased by choosing a bunch of intellectuals. Not that this isn't really important, it really is important. So my real question is, thanks so much, John, for the spirit in which you express everything. Is there a, since your email inbox is full, and there are really amazing people around, can we develop, you know, the state presidents are not going to do it. It's a great suggestion, but the church is not going to institutionalize a mentor program. But we could, in fact, have a place that we went and we said, you know, I'm not perfect, but I have been through a lot, and I am faithful, and I want to be available to one or two people and be a small version of what John's being. Can we organize that somehow?
So I've started a little private community to serve that exact purpose. And I don't make it public because I want to be careful who's on it helping and who's brought on to be helped. But if any of you are interested in serving in that capacity, I've already created the infrastructure to support that. And there are people in this room who are part of that community. And it's already been making a huge difference in people's lives. So just my email is mormonstories@gmail.com or johndeland@gmail.com. And if you're struggling or wanting to help people, we have a community for you.
This is for you, John. And you answered a question I did have, so I appreciate your remarks. But you raised a question that there's no way I can resolve without you answering it, and that is when you mentioned your own crisis of faith and how you went to your wife, and it would seem like it was a plural thing. We may have, I've had this experience, and we may have to leave the church. And it wasn't clear to me if she was going to get to make her choice to stay or how that worked.
Yeah. Anyone who knows my wife would know that things wouldn't work out that way if I had. I didn't mean it quite like that. Margie's had her own journey as well. I wasn't telling her what the family was going to do. And maybe I didn't quote myself exactly right. But of course she would and is on her own journey, as am I. We're both still active in the church. But we've both... Rhonda Callister did a session called For Better, For Worse, or For Apostasy with her husband, with Tom Kimball and a few others. What I've learned is that one of the most beautiful things that happens sometimes is one member of a couple has a struggle, and then the other freaks out about it. And so that person clams up or writes the course and is quiet. And if they'll leave the other alone and just say, these were my problems, but I'm not going to make them your problems, and I'm going to be the best spouse that I can be, then all of a sudden you find that this person starts having their struggles. And this person learns a greater comfort in the church after being a little more patient. And then it's this person who wants to leave, and it's this person who's saying, no, this is totally worth it, and I want to stay. And so the ideal is that couples can learn to get united. And that's a really tricky thing. That's one of the biggest goals I have. And I have this presentation on the internet. I have one called Why People Leave the Church and How We Can Help. It's had about 15,000 views on YouTube. And I have another presentation I've given called Why People Leave, called How to Stay in the Church After You Become Disaffected. And The purpose of these things are to help spouses get on the same page with their spouses, because that's one of the most important things that can happen. And I can tell you that my wife and I are on the same page, and that's made all the difference, but things don't work like that in my home, so.
Since John's quoting me, I want to add one more comment. I'm Rhonda Collister. And part of what I think is beautiful in couple relationships is when you can accept each other's journeys, even if you're not at the same place, and be supportive. Because I'm not sure my husband and I will ever be at exactly the same place, but it's wonderful talking. And the other comment I want to make in terms of the question, what can we do, is my vision of Mac and Mormon issues, which has been in Sunstone a few times, is that what I really would like to see it as being a, for those people just starting to search, can we do some articles that tell what all the references are and all the previous articles, get them on the internet, so when they search on polygamy, something comes up that, like Jane England's articles on polygamy, things that are healing and can help through that process. So it's a vision of how do we find them when they can't talk to anybody in the ward, and an internet search might be first. But get a Sunstone article written, get it posted on the internet, have a Mapping Mormon Issues site that people can search for. And then ideally have some of us making comments, you know, on those sites and telling some of our stories so that people could then contact us if we dealt with that issue, whatever issue it is. So that's kind of John's brainstorm, and we're trying to pick it up and see if we can make something happen.
In my experience, when one difficult issue causes a crisis of faith, and we start to look into it, very often we quickly run into a whole broad range of issues. Do you find that it's more effective to try to address a whole bunch of issues simultaneously, or to focus on one? And how do we favor one approach over the other in a sort of an online community and things that we're trying to do?
Yeah, if I could just speak to that, that's a very good question. Generally speaking, a person in a crisis of faith experience has multiple concerns. My answer to your question, I don't know if it's going to be satisfactory or not, but I got to a point where all the concerns that I had could ultimately be deduced to some sort of logical argument. And as everyone knows, deductive logic is limited by its assumptions. And so because of that, any argument that you make or try to make that is reason-based or logical tends to be easy to attack one way or the other. And so once I came to that realization, I just decided, you know what, rather than trying to fight all of these concerns at once, maybe I should just re-examine my overall approach to this. Is trying to fight with these questions on an individual basis even the right approach? Or do I just need to reconfigure my paradigm for how I'm approaching this this experience in general? And that ended up being the most important thing for me personally. Maxine?
Well, Matt, I just really want to thank you for this presentation. And John, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for reframing the crisis of faith and the struggle that we, so many of us, have gone through so beautifully and so positively. And for reminding us, as some of us have said so many times, the people who struggle the most and the hardest are those who care and feel the most, and who understood the most deeply, and who engaged on the deepest levels sometimes. Also, I really appreciate your reframing those who have struggled as mentors. I think that's a message we don't hear enough at Sunstone, that we are mentors to other people, and they need us, and we need them. And I want to thank you and John for mentoring me at times in my life when I needed it, especially at Harvard. I don't want to embarrass Matt, but during my first week at Harvard, which is a difficult place, but I found myself suddenly cast into an environment that completely validated me for the first time in my life. And I didn't know what to do. It put me through cognitive dissonance for a month because I had always worked in an environment that completely invalidated me. And so I was disoriented by validation, which was a whole new experience. And Matt was completing his final semester as I was experiencing my first week on Harvard campus, and Matt mentored me in a very kind, generous way. So thank you.
Thank you, Maxine. You're a wonderful human being. I love you.
I'm going to let Maxine's acknowledgement be the end of this, but I know we'll continue these conversations out in the halls. Okay? Thank you, John and Matt.